Go Strategic is pleased to present the School of Strategic Living. This is Lesson 12, entitled The Ontological Question by Walter Dürer.
We are in the middle of trying to define a biblical Christian worldview. We have looked first at an overview of the history of philosophy and have basically recognized two big trends. That is, man, who in the old has been important, having its place within the cosmos, has increasingly put himself into the center, to the high peak of humanism, where he has become the measurement of all reality, and indeed has become God. Where God in the old days has been seen as the final principle, the one putting order to everything that is, and he, to the contrary of the movement of man becoming increasingly more important, God became increasingly more dispensable, or his influence was declining to the point where in our century people thought he was just a projection, he was the cause for neurosis, or he was opium for the people. And of course we're talking about those people, Feuerbach, who has introduced materialism, and we're talking about Freud, who has introduced the psychoanalysis, and then Karl Marx, who has introduced Marxism. And those three people probably have changed the climate and the culture of our world more than anybody else in our time. If you go farther back, we have a few more other philosophers who had incredible impact. We would have to, of course, look at Hegel as one very important person, and for the German thinking or German way of looking at things, and he's influenced German theology, German philosophy like no other, of course, Immanuel Kant. We then looked at the four basic philosophical questions. We're trying to first get an orientation. What are those questions? Very simple questions. Where am I coming from? Not only where am I coming from, but where are we all coming from? Looking at the ontological question, we recognize that there are basically two categories of answers. One category is that there has been a personal start or a supernatural start, and then all other answers would be subsumed under no, there is a natural start, which means there is no being or no person and no supernatural being in the beginning. So it is a natural process, and there are two options. It could be a materialistic or it could be a spirit process, depending on your worldview or depending on the kind of choices that you take to how you view reality. Christian perspective, of course, and we will look at this today more carefully, at the ontological question, is that there is a personal start. Again, we'll go deeper into that. We then looked at the epistemological question, and how do we know? We recognized that people who have given up on God have basically three options, but the third one is a non-discussable one. First option is we don't know at all, which means there's no discussion about how do we know. Okay? So that's a theoretical option. But for those who are still trying to find some truth, they are discussing it. And as soon as you state something, as soon as you quote something, you are stating it as truth. So you claim truth. If you truly don't claim truth, it's the end of communication. And Schaeffer has aptly said, there has always been a lot of communication about the fact that there should be no communication. So what can we do? Epistemologically, you either trust the outside to be a reliable source of information, which brings you to the senses, five senses, or to the inside, which makes you either an empiricist, trusting the outside information coming in, or you're a rationalist, which means you're only trusting your insight. And we have briefly looked at René Descartes as the main turning point or the main focal point to articulate this mistrust in the outside and only being able to trust the inside, which brings us to rationalism. Christians, of course, as I have already noted, are both rational and empiric in a sense that they use their senses, they use their brain, but they know that whatever comes through the senses, comes through the brain, is only relative and can only be validated through revelation. Only somebody who knows all the facts can interpret the facts correctly, man, being limited, being finite, always has only a limited amount of facts, therefore always only has relative answers. We then moved on to the axiological question, what is of value? And of course, value has then to do with ethics. The first question is, what is of value? The second question, what do we do with that which is valuable? If there are no values bigger than others, if all values are equal, then that just leaves us with pure situational ethics. I have nothing that I can orientate myself towards and say this is a high value, therefore I must act upon this value so-and-so in this situation. And today we have, of course, people who are proposing what is called situational ethics, which means there are no absolute values, there are no higher values, there is just a situation and you have to evaluate every situation individually, which becomes an awful stress because you're basically always thinking, evaluating the situation, and in some situations you don't have time to evaluate the situation, you just have to act. And if you don't have a clear-cut value system, or I think the Gary Edsel calls it warehouse of values, there's nothing in you that you can go back and check, you're lost. You start thinking when you should act. And the more crisis the situation, or the more crisis is in a certain situation, the faster you need to be able to act, the stronger you need to be able to rely on internal values. So the axiological question is, although maybe it looks like the most theoretical one, it's a very important one. It will have very practical output. We looked at the possibility of, for Christians, of course, God is the ultimate value. He is the only absolute in the absolute, absolute sense, in the final sense. If you do away with God, what else can you do? You can only absolutize one portion of the totality. And you take one portion out, biblically speaking, you are idolizing. You're making an idol of something that is created. One portion, one section becomes an absolute. And this is, will be the hook that you hang the whole system upon. We then moved on to the teleological question, which is the question of telos, of goal. Teleobjective, most of you would know the camera has a teleobjective. That's how I can see far. Telos, the far, the goal. Teleology, the question, where are we going? Which, interestingly enough, if you look from a comparative religion viewpoint or from a philosophical viewpoint, you realize that only in Judeo-Christian spheres or traditions do we have a concept that we are going somewhere. The Greeks did not have a concept of linear time. They had a concept of cyclic time, spiral time. So everything reoccurred and reoccurred and reoccurred. And it was only the Jewish tradition or the Jewish faith who proclaimed that there was a time when the world wasn't, and then creation happened, and there was a time when the world was. And then it started, and there will be an end. And in between, there is something called history, and it is linear. It goes from here to here. Up there, we were killing each other like mad. Why now should we not do that again? So on what basis do we develop anything like ethic if we believe truly that we have killed each other just a few thousand years ago just for food or for survival's sake? And if indeed we believe the survival of the fittest is the key to life, why on earth was then Adolf Hitler a bad guy? Now, most people in their right mind would hate Hitler and Nazism. And especially in this country, you have fought against him. But most people still believe that evolution is the key to life. And my question simply is, what makes Adolf Hitler wrong? Or what gives you the right to call him a beast or something else? If you truly believe what you are believing, on what basis, man on earth, are you challenging him? So those are just the little sidelights to see or to show you the consequences. We don't have time to go into ethics or those kind of things, but it's real. And you can go to Peter Singer, which is a Jew, Australian Jew, who is now basically proposing euthanasia as one option of life. And it's quite interesting that an Australian Jew, of all people, would propose that. Why? Is he psychotic? No, he's at least consequent to his own presuppositions, and most other people aren't. See? Most people have presuppositions, and they don't live in line with their own presuppositions. They have romantic Christian heritage, and have a certain non-Christian presupposition in their thinking. They're not aware of their own presuppositions. So if truly we would believe, and we are now examining the second possibility to answer the question, why is there anything rather than nothing? If truly we would believe that matter, energy, time and chance produced everything that there is, we probably, if we want to be consistent, would not have a basis, or not probably, we don't have a basis, to call man something special. That therefore man should have certain rights that cannot be taken away from him. Therefore, we can argue on that basis, we can discuss issues of abortion and euthanasia. But of course, it's consistent to the presupposition. But we cannot call Hitler a bad guy at the same time. Or we have to do quite some acrobatic in our thinking. In this view, that everything is basically evolving, we might want to ask the question, some of you already mentioned the fact, chance has, if it is truly chance, it can go in any direction, up and down, forward and backward. The question is, one penetrating question for those believing in evolution, is if indeed it is chance, why do you believe in evolution and not in devolution? Why on earth is it going upwards? Why should there be a teleology, a direction, if you believe in chance? I mean, you say it, it's not me that says it. Okay? Let's argue on their own turf. Why is there an evolution? So if there is a direction. There is some spirit. There's something more than just chance.
That which is de-evolving will not survive that which is evolving. That which is evolving should be stronger than that which is evolving.
Yes, that's the survival of the fittest. I understand that argument, of course. But then, that which is now evolving here creates babies. And why should that have something that evolves further on and then doesn't go down here? So in other words, we still hold that within those up and downs in smaller measure, overall, there is a direction. Overall, there is a certain direction. So there should be, how can we answer the question of teleology? We really can't with this presupposition. Of course, we don't have any basis for personality or for human rights. Why on earth have a human rights declaration? Again, I want to draw your attention, it's a secularized version of the image of God. And if you do away with God, how long can you hold the secularized version of that thought that has no other foundation than in the Christian heritage? How about unity of individual things? Or that is the question of universals. Is there anything giving meaning to the particulars, to the single parts? Is there anything holding things together? Or isn't there anything? And what about values? See, Vukatkis was arguing, the ethic guy here, says, why should there be a value that it is good not to hurt the other if I profit from it, if I hurt the other? Why should I not take what is the other's so that I can profit? On what basis? What value? And he says, we are stressing ourselves with a so-called ethic when indeed this is unnatural for us. This is his argument here. Why not become natural? Yeah. Well, thank you for being natural. Why are we sitting down here in this unnatural surrounding? Because we don't want to be killed by the sun. Why do we build houses, which is an unnatural thing? It would be much more natural to sleep in the snow, wouldn't it? I mean, think about it. We are constantly fighting nature. to survive. So who wants to go back to Mother Earth? Now we want to be good stewards. And Christians should be in the forefront of taking care of the earth. We want to be good stewards. I don't want to go to the other extreme. But going back to nature is just pure cruelty. The natural way of life, quote unquote, is killing and the strong survival of the fittest, quote unquote. And that's not what we're called to be. So we have had quite some challenges ahead of us. And we have evaluated briefly, we could go much deeper, briefly, the evolutionary hypothesis and have proven that on that basis, it's quite hard to maintain that man is something special. We now go on one more step and look at the third option, of course, that we haven't checked yet, which is a personal starting point, which was, remember, the question mark, looking to the point of how then could we have a personal start? What is missing in those elements? I might close this point by adding, if you truly believe in evolution, then matter, who was in the beginning, is eternal. Most people don't recognize that, but that's true. If you say it was there in the beginning, you're saying it was there all the time. Okay? It's eternal. And in matter, out of matter, in matter, and to matter, we live and we have our being. So indeed, this is materialism, and we have already noted materialism is the absolutizing of that which is relative, which is the deification or the idolizing of one component. So let's then move to number two, the personal start. And again, I would ask you to think with me and think about the reality. We now do exactly the same thing, but the other way around. We look at reality as we perceive it, and we are trying to think, if this is real, and this is real, the equation, what then must be on the other side in order to have produced this which is real? What is the necessity on the other side in order for it to be able to produce reality as we perceive it? Truth. Reality as it is, out there. Remember, truth to what is out there. Real life. So let's think for a second about reality, about things. And I challenge you one more time to think with me. Think about space. Go with me to outer space in your mind, okay? Somewhere. And then the question is, where does space end? It doesn't. Well, scientists tell us, if you would send a rocket that flies always in one direction, always straight, after how many trillion years, I don't know, but somewhere down the road, that rocket would basically be back in the same place. That's what they tell us. I don't know anything about big space out there, but that's what I understand. One big thing. That's the basic idea that they have now. So let's hypothesize that this hypothesis is real. Okay? Just for a second. If that's true, what does the human mind automatically do? The next question is, what's outside? Isn't that the truth? We cannot think finiteness. Whenever you define something in the sense of finite, you want to know what's next. Isn't that the truth? Well, how about inner space? There was a time when they thought atoms were the inseparable part, which is the Greek word atom, inseparable. In the meantime, we not only found electrons and protons, but we found quarks and even smaller parts. We're growing incredibly low. But whenever you find something, whatever the smallest part is that they just happen to find, and it gets more and more complicated to find those even smaller parts, the next question is it really the last, or is there something smaller? And even if you have no other part, the next question will be, can you still separate that smallest part? And in your mind, you are always able to separate the even smallest part one more time. Is that the truth?
Yeah.
Okay, space. What about numbers? Give me the biggest number possible. My kid always asks me, give me the biggest number. And I give him whatever. And whatever the biggest number is, there's always plus one. So we escape the problem by this figure here, this 8, which means infinite. Well, we're in trouble. We have a problem. We cannot think infinity, but we cannot think being finite. Our spirit always goes beyond. Mm-hmm. Is that the truth? Mm-hmm. Well, think history, time. Go back to the beginning of history, creation or whatever. Well, what is the automatic next thought?
What was before?
Future, the end of the world. Well, what will be afterwards? Most logical. So human beings, in reality, and in accordance with reality, always have a drive for finiteness, infiniteness. Mm-hmm. We go beyond that which is for our real life. At the same time, we have already discussed the issue, we are finite, we are limited. This is only in our spirit. But nevertheless, in our spirit, there is something of infinity in us. There was a beautiful little cartoon movie some years ago where this little guy was saying, to infinity and beyond, and then he was jumping down. Remember? It was beautiful. I mean, it was a Toy Story, or what was it? Well, yes, all those likeness. To infinity and beyond! It was deeply human. Why did we like it? Why did we like it? It was a toy. But there was something in him that's in us. So whatever created that which is real must be at least as infinite, if not much more, than that little glimpse we just had. Okay? If indeed this sign is to be serious. He can have much more infinity than we have, but not less. You see that? Somebody higher can create something lower, but something lower cannot create something higher. So if he is much bigger, much more infinite than we are, great. But there is something of infinity in us, and therefore, whatever was in the beginning must be at least as infinite as we are. So that is why Schaeffer says God must be infinite yet personal. Now if we say infinite yet personal, we are subsuming everything that we have discussed before in terms of personhood of man. Whatever it is that makes us personal, God is at least as personal as we are, if not more. Probably much more. But at least as personal as we are. So God must be infinite yet personal at the same time in order to be in the beginning creating that which we now perceive to be real. Now let's think about reality from a different viewpoint, a bit more matter. You're living here in beautiful marble. Let's hypothesize that we would build 2 log houses next to each other that would be absolutely identical. Now, I know that's not possible because no tree is identical with the other, but for a second, let's hypothesize. We have chopped logs, okay? They're all identical. 2 houses, absolutely identical. Every wire, every electrical thing, water system, pipe, every nail, everything. I mean, every switch, identical. You just go to the store, you buy everything twice, you put it in a house, okay? From a material viewpoint, those 2 houses are absolutely identical. Now let's hypothesize once more that a big tank, comes across the country and drives over one of the houses 1 more time, 2 times, 3 times, maybe 15 times. So you have a picture in your mind of a wonderful log house, and next to it, something different. Okay? Now, materially speaking, those 2 houses are identical. Absolutely. Materialistically speaking, they are identical. What in the world is the difference between one house and the other? In one house, you have single parts with no connection, with no unity, with no unity. You have individualistically, materialistically separated parts. In the other part, you have things that are connected in the right sense. Therefore, they can fulfill their function. On one hand, we have not only content, but we have form. On the other hand, we only have content, but no form. To use it in other words, in one pile you have only particulars and no universal, or very little universal. Universal meaning that which holds the particulars together into a meaning, into something useful. That which gives meaning to the particular, whatever that is the universal. Let's switch the picture. We will come back to it. Let's use another picture. Kindergarten. Playing ground outside. The kindergarten teacher is drinking a cup of coffee and is resting, and the kids are just doing whatever they like to be doing. 20 kids running around. Picture one. Picture two. The kindergarten teacher has finished his cup of coffee, comes back, calls the kids into a circle, and they play a game together in a circle, sing a song and move around. What is the difference between picture A and picture B? In the second picture, we have a higher form of unity than in the first picture. Now, in the first picture, we do not have no form of unity. We have a lower form of unity. We have 20 human beings on one grass. That's a high form of unity already. You see, we're not talking either or, we're talking levels of more unity or less unity, of more flowing together. So there is a higher form of unity if the kids play together than if everybody plays its own thing. We have now touched one of the bigger philosophical questions in a very simple form, and a basic question which philosophers have not been able to find a satisfying answer all through history. That is the question of universals and particulars, of the one and the many. Okay? That's basically the question of the one and the many, in different shades and different degrees. And we've just touched it now, and you should have an understanding what we're talking about. Oneness, higher unity or lower unity. Usefulness, because things are connected properly, it's useful. Things that are improperly connected, it's useless. Might be fun, might be whatever it is, but it's not getting its full potential of whatever the material constituency of this destroyed house could have been. And of course, you can apply it to relationship, to church, to family, to society, to everything else. But we're talking philosophically right now. Now, go one step further. What is real? See, philosophers were always struggling with this, and they had only two choices. Well, they had three, but they saw only two. This was either or, either oneness or manyness. But they weren't able to bring those two together. Politically speaking, dictatorship or anarchy. Religiously speaking, Islam is very strong in oneness. There is no individuality in Islam. There is no expression of your individual. There's no self-government, nothing like that. There's only obedience and alliance to whatever the king says. So soldiers are no personalities in themselves. They are just emanations of the king in Islam. Whereas in Christian faith, each of you is precious. Each one of you is an individual and is called to self-government. But that does not mean you're called to anarchy or American individualism. You're still called to community. But community doesn't mean you lose your personality or you lose your self-government. Community is supposed to strengthen your self-government and bring it to full unfolding, to maximum potential self-government. And the more self-government you have, the more you are able to live in community. Those two things. So, looking at reality, we see that there are individual things out there. And we also see that there is unity, because there's form and order in reality. That is reality, isn't it? Philosophically, we're in trouble, because we have no way to think those things together at the same time. So we either tend to one or to the other side. Hinduism, New Age, believes in unity, in oneness. Therefore, the manyness is just an illusion. We need to overcome the manyness. See that? Islam doesn't even believe it's an illusion. It's just not there. You are an emanation of the king as an individual person. You're not an individual. And you go to death for the king and you're in heaven. Nice for you. Great. But you're just receiving orders and acting out orders. Nothing else. That's Islam. Postmodernity has given up the idea of oneness. So they're going to the other extreme, into manyness. They don't believe that there's a unity, that there's a big idea, that there's something holding everything together. Now, that's just intellectually. They can't live on that base. Nobody can live in anarchy. But theoretically, they hold anarchy or manyness to be the right thing, and they're over here. Now, if we look at reality with an unbiased view, we must say we recognize that there is true unity and at the same time, true plurality or manyness. Is that a true statement? Which means that that which was in the beginning must have unity and diversity in himself, or else our observation is wrong. Can you follow that thought? If this observation of reality is real to what's there, then that which we perceive to be real must have been in the beginning. So there must be unity and diversity in whatever was in the beginning. One and many must have been in him. Which leads us to the end of this session here, the result. The Trinitarian dogma, the dogma that God is one God in three persons, is the key to the biggest philosophical problem mankind has not been able to solve. That God is one, at the same time three, allows us to think that he is able to create manyness, diversity, and to see that positive. Dennis Peacock was speaking about God's big plan or big intention for nations to exist in heaven. See, Christians who believe that in the end we will all be one big lump of one big mass just before God, one big mass of whatever, they believe, they have in the back of their mind a certain ideal of unity which has to overcome the differences that are between us. Somehow God will bring us all back into unity, into oneness. And then oneness and unity, which is a biblical mandate, becomes a dogma or something that brings us into forcefully into something else. Whereas God will rejoice in the worship of every tribe, every tongue, every nation. The diversity will be there all eternity, and we will rejoice and celebrate it. It's a wonderful thing that you are an individual, that you are different than your sister, that you are different than your parent, that you are who you are. And for you individually, that Christ died. It's wonderful. He loves you. But you are a community dweller. You are not on your own. You're not an island on your own. So you are one, but you are in many. So in God, we have unity and diversity. And because that is true, we can rejoice in diversity, yet celebrate unity, and live not in either or, but both and. So I have this little statement: only the triune God of the Bible meets all these qualifications. He, triune God, is not one answer. It's not even the best answer. He is the only answer for reality. If reality is real, which we hold to be true, then the triune God is the only answer for that reality.
This is a copyrighted program of Go Strategic, Santa Rosa, California. Unauthorized reproduction is prohibited. Go Strategic is an international nonprofit organization that educates and equips leaders and others for effective service and leadership using biblical principles. For more information, visit us online at www.gostrategic.org.